Trend now.
It's back to Cooks and Shungu
on 702.
24 minutes before 7 o'clock, you are on your 702 weekend breakfast, the Easter Sunday edition of the show with me, Cooks and Shungu. A WhatsApp message on Andre from Andre says, don't let the temptation fool you. As a prefect, I once confiscated a piece of Brooklax that melted into another shape. I sat in class looking at it and thought, what the hell? When I got home, I paid the price. I went straight to the mall, and walking home, I ended up walking real slow. Brenda also says, if the sender hasn't surfaced up to now, it's high time you remove it from your fridge. It doesn't deserve a place in there due to the dodgy nature of the secrecy around it. That's from Brenda on our WhatsApp hotline. So some very sage advice from Andre and Brenda to avoid temptation.
Weekend breakfast with Googs and Shungu.
It's 23 minutes before 7 o'clock. Time for us to get into our nature diary. And as mentioned, this week we're talking about alien invasive plant species, in particular the water hyacinth. And we're joined in studio, as always, by resident CSI and nature conservationist Tim Neary. In a moment, we'll also be joined by Dumi Mpahlele, who is the founder of social enterprise at Tiega Movement. Tim, a very good morning to you.
Good morning. I was just chuckling at that quietly, the Brooklax story.
Yes.
So if you take chocolate and put it in the deep freeze,
mm-hmm.
and then you whack it with a hammer,
yes.
it shatters up nicely, and we used to do chocolate sandwiches for school, which there was always some sod used to go along and nick them.
Okay.
So we put Brooklax on the next couple of sandwiches. Solved the problem.
No more stolen sandwiches.
Nope. Leave the chocolate sandwiches alone.
And you never accidentally ate the Brooklax sandwiches?
No. They were my sandwiches.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
We're trying to figure out if I should eat a cake that was delivered with no name. And so I think I'm just going to abandon the cake.
Could be turbo cookies inside there.
See. Yeah. I mean, it's brand new. It's like a store-bought cake. But I'm still not. I'm too suspecting to go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why are we talking about something a little less delicious than chocolate cake?
Well, yes, it is a little less delicious. So there are a couple of interesting things that we've always said. You know that we had flying boats in South Africa that flew from Longobon all the way up to St. Lucia Lake and then up through Africa. And one of the reasons that we don't have flying boats in South Africa is the biological control on our dams and the movement and the fact that flying boats move stuff on their hulls. So,
right.
So do ducks. And ducks get all sorts of things on their feathers and on their feet in particular. And people with ski boats and boats going from dam to dam to dam.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we've seen an explosion of water hyacinth in South Africa.
Now, where does it come from originally?
A lot of it is South American.
Oh, okay.
How we get it here, I suppose it's like everything. It's almost like suitcase malaria. It's arrived somewhere on a package, on a boat hull or whatever, you know, it's come somewhere. Or else, of course, the other thing that we had where somebody may have liked what it looks like in their home country and brought it out to put it on a little pond in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And then it multiplied out from there. We don't know exactly where it stemmed from. But what we do know is that it chokes the water. We do know that it removes a lot of the oxygen from the water,
mm-hmm.
and consequently makes it very hard for fish and all to live. So it messes with our system. Now, in some parts of the world, obviously, there are things that eat it. So we did that. We had the first blast of this stuff, I think, was in the 70s. And we put out sort of herbivorous type fish. And there's an insect that you can put onto this that is the biological control.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And well, and the reason this is all better is because you can spray it. And it was sprayed with herbicides many years ago. And it would sink to the bottom. And then it would create this most foul-smelling gas as it decomposed on the bottom. And then this gas would come up to the surface and be an issue. but smelly, etc. So it wasn't the right way because it then messed with the nutrients within the water. And it also is an indicator very often that the water that we've got in that dam is not that good. The nutrients are high. So somewhere like Hartbeespoort Dam has got incredibly good nutrients from sewage works that don't mostly purify to the level that they should be before setting it down, because that's why Hartie's is always full. Hartie's is always full because we flush it down there from our toilets.
Oh.
Yeah, remember that what we said before? You got the Witwatersrand that runs through the middle of Joburg, and that ridge, everything to the north of the ridge goes north and off to the Indian Ocean. Everything to the south of the ridge goes south and west and off to the Atlantic Ocean. So that's kind of the split that we have. And, yeah, this stuff, unfortunately, somebody put out the wrong fish. They decided to restock Hartbeespoort Dam instead of putting in herbivorous fish that were there. They put in ones that were a little more keen on insects, and they ate the other fish, and they also ate the insects.
Oh, no.
Okay, so we've tried various things over time. You've seen they've had these floating islands in Hartie's to try and clean the water up. And they've it's almost like a floating wetland. And these worked very well as well, but they're expensive to do. And, you know, I think it's always experimental. Now, what do you do with this stuff? Well, of course, you try and spray it. That doesn't work because most of the times the herbicides that they spray them with kills the leaves but doesn't get down and kills the root part. So the damn things grow better than you've ever seen them grow before. It's something that I'm working with in KZN at the moment on a dam. And then you've got the biological control, which is ideal. Our winters are a little bit too cold, but they do very well in our summertime. So you just keep on breeding the bugs and releasing them as they are. But when it gets to the stage of Hartie's and some of the and this particular dam that I've got to deal with, it's too much and the bugs can't manage it, etc. So what do you do with it? You've got to mechanically remove it.
So and go into the water.
Go into the water and pull it out to the side. Now, it's also very good as a fertilizer. It can be used as an animal feed. Problem is that it also removes, the good thing it does is it takes heavy metals out of water or and out of that environment. So it can't be used, Hartie's can't be used for cattle feed. So now we have a problem. What do we do with this? And I was at this conference that Barbara Creasy and crew have just had where they want to look at the utilization of our natural resources and make billions of rand, not realizing that most of our natural resources are actually rare, threatened and endangered. But that's a separate program. And I was walking around and I saw on a screen there was a water hyacinth with that confounded, beautiful-looking little flower on. And I said to the young lady, what's that doing here? And she pointed to me and she said, that is that. And she showed me the most beautifully made baskets and the most beautifully created biofuel. So when you go to places like Builder's Warehouse and all, particularly you see them in winter, people have got these biologs, which is sawdust that's been compressed with a hole down the middle, and you can break them off and use as much as you want to. And they've created biologs out of the Hartbeespoort. Well, not they're working at Blessbok Spruit. But the question is, what I like about this is we're taking something that's an alien invader and we're turning it into a product and turning it into a business. Okay. Now, that to me is the right way of dealing it, because the cost of management of this is continuous. You can't get, you're not going to get rid of this weed. It's one of those things where when you get into that operation, you realize that you're in for 5 years. That's just to clean it out. Now you're going to have another 5 years at least plus of management. Okay, so there's a difference. You get that clean out phase and then you've got a management phase to ensure it doesn't get back up to where it was.
Yeah.
And of course, the interesting point as well is legally, we've got to clear the dams. In terms of the law, it's a category, I think, 2 invader, and it has to be removed from the water. But, of course, government have to sit back because they've got no money to do these things. They sit back and say, well, it's somebody else's problem. Well, whose problem? Okay, first of all, government, you own the water. Okay, water doesn't belong to you, doesn't belong to me, doesn't belong to the farmer. You own the water. Mm. The state owns the water. And this is on the water. But of course, they say because it's on your land, you need to be responsible.
Yeah.
Conveniently, let's shift the blame. But that's when we discovered that Toomey, when I got a little business card and I spoke to Toomey, and I thought, hang on a minute.
This is interesting.
This is interesting. Here we've got somebody that's taken some initiative and not looking for handouts, but going about and creating a business. Mm. And I like this.
Speaking of Toomey, Toomey Mphahlele is the founder of social enterprise Tega Movement. They were founded in 2021. They're a social enterprise. Their business, their core business, is dealing with this issue of alien invasive plant species. And Toomey joins us on the line this morning. Toomey, a very good morning to you. Welcome to Weekend Breakfast.
Thank you very much. Good morning to you, Gugu. Good morning to Tim and all the 702 listeners this morning.
Tell us how you got into the business of repurposing an invasive alien plant species.
Okay, sure. It's quite a bit of a story, but I'll try to summarize it as best as I can. It started over about 10 to 12 years ago when I worked for another company called MGrow Neutrology, where they used to sort of clean dams. We're using EM, effective microorganisms. So I was sent to Marula Science to look at the situation there, and that's where I met Hyacinth for the first time, and I realized that our solution wouldn't work there because it would actually add nutrients to the water system. So I then spoke to the general manager of the hotel, and at the time she referred me to DFFE just to see what we could do, and at the time it wasn't allowed because as Tim put it, there's been a long journey with the management and control of water hyacinth. And at the time, the control method was through chemical, through the use of herbicides. So they were not allowing for beneficiation or value-added products made out of the water hyacinth. Fast forward about 9 years later, I attended one of the special interest talks at Brentford Gardens, hosted by Mr. and Mrs. Oppenheimer. And I then started having a conversation with Dr. Duncan McFadden, and we moved it over to his office a week later. And we're sitting there, and at some point the conversation morphed, and we looked at each other, and we're like, no, let's do something about the water hyacinth. Let's create a project. Let's put our heads together, and let's brainstorm, because it's something that has always been near and dear to my heart. And I was a bit nervous and apprehensive because I was like, okay, what's the DFFE going to say? Sorry, the DFFE being the Department of Fishery, Forestry and Environment, because back then, you know, they had said, no, it's not allowed. And I would call it serendipity because, funny, 2 months later, I got a call from the DFFE and they asked me, hey, we're looking at rehabilitating the Blessbox Brait wetland. It formerly enjoyed a Ramsar status and it's lost it. And we're working with the Dutch water authorities. And are you interested in applying some of the ideas that you had to the Blessbox Brait? And I was like, definitely. I went back to Dr. Duncan and I gave him the good news. And, you know, he was very excited. And the project started then through the support of Oppenheimer Generations Research into Conservation, who seeded the ideation phase right through to where we are right now.
And so, Toomey, where are you now? What does your social enterprise do?
Okay. So then the project started where we trained a community of 30 women around the wetland in Ekurhuleni, which is a Slovo community. We enrolled them. We trained them for about 6 months and gave them the hard skills on basket weaving as well as, you know, soft skills on entrepreneurship. And the reason why we did that was that we wanted to empower them that they can actually start their own businesses and become contract manufacturers for us when we go out and market and try to get the business into, you know, retail and other distribution channels. We realized also that the hyacinth was outgrowing our capacity because it grows at an estimated ratio, it propagates at an estimated ratio of about 1 to 24. So for every one mother plant, there are 24 daughter plants. And we realized that, no, we need something that can scale at a significant rate in terms of end product. And that's where the briquetting was born, where we looked at some of the waste, because when we weave, we only use a stem. The rest of the plants is discarded, i.e. the roots as well as the leaves. And also, it's very seasonal. We can only weave when the hyacinth grows to about 30 to 60 centimeters. That means throughout the year, we're discarding a lot of water hyacinth that could be repurposed as well. So that's when we decided to crush everything and, you know, separate our operations. So we've got the weaving side that happens at the wetland in the community hall. And then we set up a workshop also in Springs, in New Era, where with my partner there, we then, invested in a briquetting machine. And we started doing a lot of R&D, going back and forth, experimenting, trialing, until we eventually got a drive. Because a lot of the machines that are used for briquetting are made specifically for sawdust, the compatibility was a bit difficult. So we struggled a little bit. We spent days and nights for about 6 to 8 months trying to get it dried. And eventually we got our first briquette, and then we found a system and a method of briquetting the hyacinth using no binders. And through that, we engaged a couple of FMCG companies. One, which I'm not going to mention by name, but took a keen interest in our project, such that they gave us an expression of interest where they would like to convert their current boiler, which uses natural gas, to a biomass boiler. And they're very interested in using us. And that for us is exciting, because that means we're going to get the volume. When we have the volume, the shoreline remediation becomes expensive. I mean, it becomes feasible, because once the hyacinth is removed, it sits on the shoreline. There are a lot of methane gas emissions. There's no budget. Usually with government, when they're removed, there's no budget for the remediation of the shoreline, which is removing the water hyacinth from the shoreline and into a landfill. And that's really where we come in. But it's an expensive process. So if we have an off-taker that's willing to off-take our briquettes at a mass scale, then, you know, we get a good return on the effort that we make into, one, removing the hyacinth from the shoreline, and then, again, beneficiating the processing and industrialization. So back to your question, where we are now, we've just completed our R&D and pilot cycle, and we are then preparing for commercial trials. We've also got a retail division of the briquette, where we are packaging it into 4 kilograms and are trying to get traction with the traditional retailers. It's been very challenging. I don't think it's difficult. It's just a social capital issue where we don't necessarily have all the right networks, but we are trying to get into your mass mods, your pick and pays, even your petrol stations. We've just also got a distributor on the briquette side, and we've also onboarded another distributor for the baskets as well. We're trying to scale. We're trying to raise capital to build a bigger factory so that we can meet some of the demand that we're trying to create. And on the basket weaving side, the exciting thing about it is how the women have just turned into women who were sitting in their communities unemployed, to women who have become so passionate about weaving and hyacinth because of how it's transformed their lives from an income perspective, from a skills perspective, such that I feel that from the training, they've become stewards for water hyacinth. They go around talking to their friends and family about water hyacinth. They teach, they educate the community. And I think that for me is the most exciting part of the work that we've done so far.
To me, the one concerning thing I think one always has with this is that there's X amount of hyacinth. And I suppose the thing is this a 10-year project, a 15-year project, or a 5-year project before you run out of product? I mean, that's always the issue. But of course, the speed, as you say, at which the stuff grows, and I'm assuming that you could have a pretty large briquette plant operating off a Hartbeespoort sport dam. You know, I was listening to what Tumi was saying there about getting into the major retailers and what have you. Hopefully there's a major retailer listening this morning that manages to sell rare, threatened, endangered species wood in their shop, being various timbers, which we've spoken about, as briarwood. hopefully they're listening and might contact you and do something about it, because that word that you used there, Googs, I really liked, repurposing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you know, we always look at the expensive ways of getting rid of. We're talking about job creation, okay? Tumi's doing this, right? So hopefully, again, there is capital needed to be raised. And, you know, I would think that people like the Green Fund of Nedbank and all should actually be clamoring over themselves to come and have a look at this little lot and say, hang on, how do we make this work?
Mm.
This is pure job creation. It's pure, it's utilizing a product. It's turning it into, it's lowering the need, for example, of cutting down indigenous wood for fires, because a lot of our South African folk, huge numbers, still use timber as a fire source or as a energy source to cook. Mm. Hello, excuse me. This is possibly a very good way. To me, I really like what you guys have done. And I think, you know, to you, Duncan, Strelia, Nikki, and for getting behind you guys, well done.
Thank you.
You know, and I think it's tremendously important. So I actually want to come out and have a look at this thing.
Yeah, and where do we find your products? Are they available online? Are you on social media? How do we see the work that you're doing?
Google, yes, we are online. Our website is www.techa.co.za. Instagram handle is at Techa, T-H-E-K-G-A, underscore Eco Living. And then on Facebook, it's Techa Eco Living.
And I think, you know, again, look at the products that have been made there, Googs. They've got a lovely little basket where you can put your candle in a glass into it. And the baskets are really nice. You know, they're those sort of things that you could have on your patio, on your veranda, on your, doesn't matter where you are. Mm-hmm. There's lovely value. And just to know that this has been used and repurposed, I really like that.
Yeah.
I'm going to use that word of yours.
Repurpose.
Repurposing of alien invaders. And doing something about it.
Mm. Tumi, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Gugu. Thank you so much, Tum, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's Tumi Mpahlele. She's the founder of a social enterprise called Techa Movement. You can find them at techa.co.za. That's their website. At Techa underscore Eco Living on Instagram. And you can check out their products, which I think that's actually really cool.
It's very cool. You know, they were talking at that conference consistently about the medicinal plants in South Africa. And I poked my hand up and said, very nice. Do you realize that most of them are rare, threatened, and endangered?
Yeah.
Okay. We haven't got spare. This sort of thing is what we should be looking at. This is real job creation. And this is dealing with an alien invader in the right way.
Mm.
I like it.
I like it too. Tim, thank you so much for joining us. As always, it's great to chat to you. You promised me giraffes.
Yes, I in fact, I spoke to the prof this week. He's back from chasing giraffes. So hopefully in the next week or so, we'll talk about
them. There will be giraffes.
And then I'm going to ask you about their horns.
Giraffes have horns?
Yes, with those little thingies stuck on the top of them. Oh. What's so special about them?
I don't know.
How many bones in a giraffe's neck? Think how long it is.